Hare Krishna. Welcome back to the Nectar of Instruction series which we are doing in the Bhakti Shastri. Now we will go deeper into our discussion on association. In the previous two texts we have discussed first about the sixfold exchanges, Dati Pati Grahanati, and then after that we discussed about respecting different devotees who are at different levels of spiritual advancement. And now we will discuss about the advanced devotee, especially how such a devotee should not be seen with material vision. So let's look at the text over here. So it is drishta svabhava janitair apushascha doshair na prakritattvam iha bhakta janasya pashyet gangambhasam na khaludbudbudhafen pankair brahmadravatvam pagacchati nira dharmair. So, drishtai svabhava janitair vapushascha doshair. So, drishtai means when we see with our eyes, svabhava janitair, what is born from the svabhava, from nature, vapushascha doshair. Vapusha is the body. So, the dosha is the faults. So, whatever difficulties are present in the body, na prakrutattvam iha bhakta janasya pashyet. So, they are drishtai, they are visible, but na pashyet. One should not see them. Prakrutattvam. Because they are material. The devotee is essentially practicing spiritual life, especially the acharya is teaching a spiritual life. So, na pashyet, iha bhakta janasya. For such devotees, one should not see. Why? And the example is given, how one should not see. Gangam bhasam, na khalu budbud fena pankair. Gangam bhasam, in the water of the Ganga, budbud fena pankair. So, there are bubbles, there is foam, there is dirt. But these one does not see. One understands that the purity of the Ganga is transcendental. Brahma dravattam apagacchati nira dharmai. So, what will happen because of it being water, that will happen, nira dharmai. But Brahma dravattam, its transcendental nature is not affected, apagacchati. So, just as Ganga water remains pure in spite of the presence of impure things like bubbles and foam and dirt. Similarly, a pure devotee remains, advanced devotee remains transcendental, even if there are some bodily defects. So, being situated in his original Krishna conscious position, a pure devotee does not identify with the body. Such a devotee should not be seen from a materialistic point of view. Indeed, one should overlook a devotee's having a body born in a low family, a body with a bad complexion, a deformed body, or a diseased or infirm body. According to our innovations, such imperfections may seem prominent in the body of a pure devotee. But despite such seeming defects, the body of a pure devotee cannot be polluted. It is exactly like the waters of the Ganges, which sometimes during the rainy season are full of bubbles, foam and mud. The Ganges water do not become polluted. Those who are advanced in spiritual understanding will bathe in the Ganges without considering the condition of the water. So, Srila Prabhupada actually integrates the purport in the translation because he gives multiple examples. Here, for example, this whole sentence is Srila Prabhupada's expression, na prakrutattvam iha bhakta janasya pashyet. So, the various things that cannot be, that may be seen, this, especially this sentence, one should overlook. What all one should overlook? The specific examples are not there in the text, but Srila Prabhupada is giving it to make it clear for us what na prakrutattvam means. Don't see from a material point of view. So, born in a low family, bad complexion, deformed body, or diseased or infirm body. Now, difference between bad complexion, deformed and diseased is that bad complexion means the looks are not very good. Deformed means the body is shaped improperly. Maybe some limbs are missing, some fingers are missing. And diseased or infirm body means maybe, and there's a lot of cough and mucus coming out, or there is pus because of some disease, as it happened to Sanatana Goswami. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not see that and still embraced. So these are all different points, they are distinctive, all of them. And in spite of that, a devotee remains transcendental. And Prabhupada said these may be prominent, they may seem prominent, but despite, and actually, they are not even, Prabhupada said, they are not even defects, but seeming defects. The body is not polluted. Why? Because it is used for the service of Krishna and in that sense it remains always pure. So let's look at the purport. We'll see over here the overview. So in the sixth text over here, the offenses against a pure devotee. What are the possible offenses? Prabhupada explains criticism of bodily defects. So what are the bodily defects possible? Prabhupada gives a list of that, and Srila Prabhupada connects that with apichet sudaracharo. So we may wonder, why are bodily defects present in the body of someone? And sometimes you may start thinking, oh, it's because of this person must have done some bad karma, because of which those bodily defects are present. See, first thing we have to understand is that the principle of karma is not to be applied for post-mortem. It is always to be applied for prognosis. Post-mortem means that, you know, when a person is suffering, we have no business inquiring what bad karma the person did because of which that person is suffering. It is karma, the principle of karma is for us to understand that if I do wrong activities, I'll get wrong consequences. Now, if we start applying karma for post-mortem, then there is no limit. You know, when a mother is caring for a baby and the baby starts crying, the mother starts thinking, oh, the baby is crying, must be feeling some pain. That pain is because of some past karma. So let the baby cry. You know, we will just choke all love and choke all humanity out of our relationships if we start bringing past karma into our interaction with each other. We need to interact with each other based on human culture and indeed devotional culture, which is extremely sensitive. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not ever say to Sanatana Goswami, all these boils have come upon you, you know, what sinful karma did you do? You know, he said, no, I am a sannyasi and I should be able to see beyond the externals. So without, if I don't see beyond externals to the essence, the soul, then I am having a, there is a defect in my sannyas. I am not truly renounced. So he did not focus on what that person's karma was. He focused on what his dharma was. So in all situations when we are dealing with others, we have to consider what is our dharma. And imagine if we start thinking that people are suffering because of their bad karma, then, you know, a thief goes and robs in a person's house and the person goes to the king. He says, I've been robbed. It's your past karma that you've been robbed. Where will justice remain in that situation? So when we deal with people, we deal with them based on their this life situation. Based on their this life situation. How, what is their situation in this life? You know, if a person has earned money honestly, and after that has been robbed, then there is no way, no point for us. We have no right to consider what the past karma of that person was because of which the person got robbed. From this point, this life's point of view, it's wrong. And the king has to take the responsibility and make sure that the robber is punished and the stolen amount is returned. When this, last year, there was a terrible gang rape in Delhi. So I wrote an article about that. So after that, I was asked a question on my website. Now, what was the karma of that woman who was raped? So this is not a question which we should be asking at all. When Draupadi was disrobed, nobody asked what was the karma because of which you were disrobed. No. They all understood that this was a monstrous injustice and it had to be punished. So when a person is suffering at that time, we should not be doing a post-mortem, oh, this suffering has come because of some past karma. We should be thinking, what is my dharma? How can I help in such a situation? So, if we don't keep the philosophy of karma in its proper perspective, its perspective is, it is a philosophy of accountability, that we are accountable for our actions. What I do, I will get the consequences. And therefore, I should act according to my dharma. So, if a king, even if the king thinks philosophically, oh, this person has been robbed because that person must have done some bad karma. But that is not the king's business. What the king has to think, what is my dharma right now? My dharma is to protect my citizens and to punish wrongdoers. So I must do that. If I fail in my dharma, then I will be doing bad karma and I will get consequences for that. So we are not meant to judge people based on their karma. We are meant to decide our actions based on our dharma. So what is our dharma? mother's dharma is to care for the child. She has given birth to the child, it is her child, that infant depends on her. And the infant is crying, it is her dharma to take care of the child. So at that time we cannot bring the past karma into the issue. Now, we also talk from another perspective that people are suffering because of their past karma. So, what is the use of, sometimes somebody would say, what is the use of humanitarian help? So, when we say what is the use of humanitarian help, it just means that humanitarian help is incomplete. We shouldn't get too sentimental and think, oh, people are starving, I should give them food. Yes, we should help people if they're starving, we can give them prasad, definitely. But the point is that if people's karmic wrongs are not corrected, then at a material level, only helping will not lead to any lasting solution. So that doesn't mean that there is all material help is banned. The point is, we recognize material help is incomplete. But incomplete doesn't mean that it is useless. Now, when a mother caresses for a crying child, that doesn't solve the child's problem completely. But that doesn't mean mother's caring for the child is useless. It has to be there. That care has to be there. That's a part of the mother's dharma. But when we talk about Krishna consciousness, we say that the dharma is not just to take care of the body, it's also to take care of the soul. So there's a complete social service. Now, we should not become insensitive in the name of being spiritual. So now, this is with respect to even ordinary people. We cannot apply this postmodern analysis. This person is suffering. Why is this person suffering? Because of past bad karma. More than that, we also should think of further, what is my dharma, and more, all the more so with respect to devotees. If some devotee is sincerely practicing devotional service, then even if the devotee has some bodily defects, now those bodily defects may be because of some past bad karma, but that is none of our business. So why? Because we should consider, what is my dharma? Okay, this is a serious devotee, advanced devotee. By serving that devotee, I can make spiritual advancement, so let me serve that devotee. I have nothing to do. What that person's karma was, that is between that person and Krishna. So I don't have to bother about that. And Prabhupada says, okay, even if we assume that somebody has a bad karma, Prabhupada takes the possibility and says over here, this verse from the Bhagavad Gita 9.30-31, these are very important verses. Krishna says, apichet sudaracharo bhajate mam ananya bhag. Sadhur eva samantavya samyak vyavasito hi saha. So even if my devotee commits the most sinful activity, apichet sudaracharo. Sudarachar, durachar is bad behavior. Sudarachar is extremely bad behavior. Apichet sudaracharo bhajite mam ananya bhak. Such a person stays fixed in the practice of devotional service. Such a person is sadhur eva samantavya. So considered a sadhu. Samyak vyavasito hi saha. Samyak vyavasito hi saha means it's fixed in one pointed. It should be considered a sadhu because it's fixed in devotional service. So now we will discuss this verse elaborately when we study Bhagavad Gita. But in this context, even if a devotee has committed some sudurachar in the past, that is how Srila Prabhupada is integrating it over here. Even if the devotee has committed something in the past, now what is the situation? Now the devotee is serving Krishna sincerely. If the devotee is serving Krishna sincerely, then sadhu reva samantavyaha. The person is to be considered sadhu, considered saintly. Samyak vyavasito hi saha, because the determination is properly situated. So we shouldn't let the thoughts of karma contaminate our vision when we look at devotees. We should think that, okay, whatever these defects are, they are peripheral. And the essential aspect of a devotee is that the devotee is serving Krishna. And because the devotee is serving Krishna, the devotee is glorious. Now, this actually applies to many things. Now, one time, His Holiness Jayadvait Maharaj, he was Jayadvait Prabhu in his Brahmachari days. So he asked Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada, sometimes we see that the pure devotee commits mistakes. So how do we understand this? So all the devotees became a little tense. And they were going for a morning walk. And Prabhupada, we know that there are four defects in the conditioned soul. And we say that Shastra is reliable. Because those four defects are not there in the Shastra. And also we say in those who teach Shastra. So that was the background understanding, and devotee thinking, is this question offensive? And then they said, no. He says, pure devotee never commits any mistakes. So, but Jayadutta Maharaj insisted. He said, but Prabhupada, we see that sometimes this, the pure devotee quotes some verses wrong. Prabhupada would often do that. Janma karma cha me devyam evam yovatata taktva deham pura janma naiti maameti sa Arjuna. Prabhupada sometimes would naiti maameti sa Pandava. Or Prabhupada sometimes would quote some verses wrong. You know, we see that the pure devotee quotes some verses wrong. So Prabhupada said, that is an incorrect vision of perfection. He says, what do you mean? So Satsuru Maharaj also there, he asked, what does it mean? Said, that is external vision, Prabhupada says. That means we have a wrong conception of perfection, Prabhupada said, yes. The perfection of a pure devotee is that whatever the devotee does is for the service of Krishna, is for the pleasure of Krishna. So when we are talking about perfection here, it is spiritual perfection. Spiritually, there is no mistake in the devotee's intention. The devotee's intention is to serve Krishna. And for all of us conditioned souls, we can't say that. For us, our intention is not always to serve Krishna. We have so many other intentions. Occasionally, sometimes we may have the intention of serving Krishna. Most of the time, our intention, even while doing devotional services, that I don't want to get into trouble, I don't want to get into the miseries of material existence, or I want to be considered a good devotee by others. I want to be praised by others. That's why I'm doing all this. So there is no mistake ever in the intention of a pure devotee. But when the devotee is going to act through a physical body, the devotee's intentions are transcendental. The devotee's intentions are not affected by the bodily covering that is there around, the body that the devotee is using for serving Krishna in this world. But those intentions, when they are expressed in this world, there can be some defects which come out because of the limitations of the body. So when we say that a pure devotee's body should not be seen materially, what it means is that it should not be seen to be only material. It should not be reduced down to the material. A pure devotee has transcendental intentions. And then with those transcendental intentions, the pure devotee tries to serve Krishna. Sometimes there may be some limitations of the physical body because of which certain problems come up. Srila Prabhupada's English was not perfect. English grammar, when Prabhupada would dictate his purports, there would be a lot of grammatical inconsistencies, and Jayadutta Maharaj has written a whole series of articles explaining what editing he did and why he did. So that he's given the title, Editing the Unchangeable Truth. So, you know, that which is unchangeable, how can that be edited? But Prabhupada himself told his editors. Prabhupada, in fact, told Hayagriva Prabhu, was his first editor, that one mistake in a book kills the book. Let there be not a single mistake in the book. So, Jayadvaita Maharaj is my writing guru. He's taught me writing. So, he told me that for every Bhagavatam volume that has come out, they would have almost like a sack full of its prints which were proofread. At that time the computers were not so common. So whenever they were typed, then there would be print out taken, printing would be read to a printer, it would be read out, and so they would have a sack full of proofread material for each volume of Bhagavatam. Well, they worked painstakingly hard. So we asked, generally if we are publishing a book, how many times should we proofread it? So he said, not more than 25 times. Not more than 25 times. So I had a friend in my pre-devotional days, whose hobby was to purchase popular books and read those books and find out mistakes in those books, and then pack that and send it to the writer. These are the mistakes I found in your book. So he used to get some kick out of that. You know, try to show how his English is better than the English of the best author, most popular authors of the times. So he got Prabhupada's books and he just reread so many books, he just couldn't find any mistake anywhere. So that was because the devotees worked so hard over there. So in the early days, the devotees were thinking. So one time, while speaking, Srila Prabhupada had used a word that was not there in the English language only. Now from the context, we can make out what is the meaning that Prabhupada intended. And the devotees understood there should be a new word. So the editors were discussing. They were all young and quite naive at that time. They said, If pure devotee has used this word, then rather than changing the word, we should change the dictionary. And we should include this word in the dictionary. So the devotee started thinking, what should we do? That sentiment is good. But then they decided we should ask Prabhupada what to do. So they went and asked Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, no, change the word. So Prabhupada was very practical. Now, Prabhupada was very practical in the sense that he understood that. In fact, when Hayagiri Prabhu offered to edit, Prabhupada said, make it perfect. Prabhupada himself admits in his, no, not just in a conversation or a lecture or a letter, in his own Bhagavatam purports, Prabhupada says that our attempt to present this great literature in a foreign language will certainly be a failure. But since this is a science of technical values, of transcendental values, we hope that that essential message will be accepted by intelligent people all over the world. So Prabhupada wrote his first canto, he published his first canto in India. And he was publishing in India. At that time he was practically alone, poverty-stricken, living in Vrindavan, somehow managing his finances as a sannyasi, as a vanaprastha. And for many years, first he was vanaprastha, then he was sannyasi. But at that time he had no assistant, so he had no editor at all. So Prabhupada would himself write, then he would himself type, then he would himself take to the printer, then he would himself proofread, and then he would himself collect the copies and send them to shopkeepers and distributors. So he was a one-man army at that time. So Prabhupada writes in the purport that he was aware that his English was not perfect. And there were defects in his English. But Prabhupada said that, use the example in the Bhagavatam purport. This is the purport which, there are two verses in the Bhagavatam in the fifth chapter of the first canto, which compare, you know, that literature which is glorifying Krishna, that is perfect. And that yadva tadva visargo janada viplavo yasmin pratishlokam avadavatyapi namani anantasya shonkitani shrunvanti gayanti vranti sadhu. So tadva visargo janada viplavo, those words janat ag viplava, they will do a revolution in the sinful lives of ordinary people. Yasmin pratishlokam avadavatyapi, even if every shloka. Now, this is not even talking about English translation. It is saying about, even if that literature, it is a shloka, it is written in Sanskrit to glorify the Lord. Even if that has defects, and not just one or two defects, pratishloka madhavadvatyapi. Even if there is a defect in each word, still, because it is glorifying the Supreme Lord, namani anantasya shonkitani yat shunvanti gayanti grananti sadha, that the wise people will hear it, will accept it and relish it. They'll speak it. So this is not just Prabhupada saying this. Prabhupada's elaborating his situation, his presentation in English language. But the original is talking even about Sanskrit shlokas having defects. So the point here is that material defects do not affect the transcendental potency of a pure devotee or a pure devotee's words. So now why was the editing required? Because when people approach a book, people don't realize the transcendental potency immediately. So if they see material defects, then they will just put off, the grammar is also not good, what will be the use of the message? And they will reject the message. So because people will approach this message with the material vision, therefore, for them, to assist them in accessing the message without any unnecessary negative perceptions, we remove the defects, whatever defects are there, in the terms of grammar or punctuation or things like that. So these are peripheral, and we should be able to see beyond this to the essential message. And the essential message is transcendental, the central message is transcendental. So we were discussing about apichet sudaracharo. Apichet sudaracharo. So even if a devotee has committed some terrible sinful activity in the past, that doesn't matter. And because of that, there are some limitations now. Whatever be the limitations that have come now, it doesn't matter because now the devotee is serving Krishna. So whatever defects we see in a devotee's body, we should just put them aside. You know, even if the Ganga has some dirt in it, has some vein in it, still Ganga remains transcendental because Ganga, there is an essence of the Ganga that is coming from the spirit, from the lotus feet of Lord Vamanadeva. And that transcendental potency of the Ganga is there within its waters, even if those waters are materially contaminated. So So of course now, if the water is toxic, because there is so much pollution, the water has almost become toxic. So if you have to drink it, we might even get poisoned by that. So then what we will do is, we'll just take one drop and we'll may not drink it, we'll just sprinkle it. Then we have to see whatever is required, because it's material, there'll be a material reaction to it. If there's toxic substances in it, that may have a reaction of a toxic effect on us. But irrespective of what happens at the material level, the transcendental potency is there. And by bathing in the Ganga, at a transcendental level, we will be purified, we'll be elevated. So we should not mix the transcendental and the material. So there are two possibilities of mixing. One is that we mistake the material to be everything and don't see the transcendental at all. That means we see the defects in a pure devotee's body and we think, oh, it's or this person is this person suffering sinful reactions. What can I learn from this person? And the other is that the aspect of we seeing the transcendental and not paying any attention to the material, especially if in certain forums that is required, like say editing. So if a book has to be presented to the public, then as per Prabhupada's instructions, it has to be edited. So the material aspect has to be adjusted in whatever way is required so that the transcendental can be accessed. So we should not let the material block the transcendental by either way, by thinking that there is no transcendental or making people see the material so prominently that they can't perceive the transcendental. So that's why we do the editing, but we understand the essential message is not required to be edited. So editing the unchangeable truth was, there is no essential message that was edited. It was only the presentation, the language, the style, the techniques that were edited of presentation. That is basically language is a tool, it's a technology which is used for communication. Editing that doesn't change anything. Some people unnecessarily criticize this editing. Actually the editing, many of the mistakes didn't come from Srila Prabhupada. They came because early days, the devotees who were hearing Prabhupada's books, who were hearing Prabhupada's dictaphone dictations and typing them, they just had no familiarity of what Prabhupada was telling. So, for example, in one of the early editions of the Bhagavad Gita, there was a Triloka. Now, where is Triloka in the spiritual, in the whole universe? Actually, there is no Triloka. That was just the devotees had misheard Pitraloka to be Triloka. So now changing this is not only essential, not changing it is violence to Prabhupada. It is violence because we are so terribly misrepresenting Prabhupada by saying that he has talked about a Triloka. And there is no Triloka as per the Vedic cosmology. So leaving such blatant mistakes within the books would be violence to Prabhupada. So we have to remove that. Now moving forward, as a devotee, now editing is a specialized field with which a few of us may have to interact, but most of us have to interact with devotees at other times. So Srila Prabhupada often talks about how there were problems which his disciples faced because of they not being born in Brahmin families or Goswami families. So when Srila Prabhupada brought his Western disciples to India, at that time several the general Indian community was amazed to see these Western devotees practicing. So in a sense, actually the whole operation was often at the platform of false ego. So at the platform of the false ego, yes, see, our culture is so great that even Western people have started practicing our culture. But then, this is our culture, so we are greater than them. They should not be considered greater than us. We were born in this culture. We are Brahmins. So if people are, anyway, if people appreciate Krishna and Krishna's devotees, that is good. But if that causes, if their platform of perception causes them to fail to appreciate Krishna and Krishna's devotees, then that is going to be a problem in their spiritual prospects. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada clarified, yes, so they were saying that these people are born in the Ichha families. How can they be devotees? And how can they be spiritual teachers? So Prabhupada quotes over here from this verse, he said that, yes, being born in a low family, dushtai swabhuvah janitair apushascha doshai. It might be a fault of the body, but the body is external to the person, and the essential person, the soul, has now devoted become devoted to Krishna. So therefore, there is no need to stay obsessed with the externals. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur would talk, tell the story of the naked Pancho. You know, some woman, when he was small, you know, he might have been wandering around without clothes, and his friend saw him like that. And then that person grows and becomes a high court judge. And that time, you know, the person is a high court judge, very responsible position, very committed, very competent, very respectable. And then as soon as the friend says, you know, I saw him unclothed. He says, what has that got to do with this now? Whatever way a person was, it doesn't matter, because that person is now in a very respectable position. So even if a devotee was born in a low family, that doesn't affect the devotee now, because the devotee has practiced devotional service and has made spiritual advancement. So drishtai svabhav janitair vapushascha doshair. There is dosha in the vapu, one should not see it. Na pashyet. And then Prabhupada explains further that who is actually a Goswami? So there are, see, who is a Goswami? Actually, Goswami is, it is not, there is no such thing as a by birth. Prabhupada says that actually, this is very provocatively, the Goswamis say that there are caste Goswamis who are descendants of the various Vamshas coming down from the Goswamis. And they say actually teaching Krishna consciousness, giving Diksha is all our monopoly. So Prabhupada just turns the argument on his head and he says that actually the title Goswami is the monopoly of the pure devotees. He says, you are not Goswamis at all, because what he says, he gives the example that Rupa Sanatan Goswami, they had become converted to Muslims almost because of the pressures of Abu Sain Shah, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted them back. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave them the name Goswamis. And what was the basis for giving them the name? If it had to be caste or birth, they had lost their caste. So they could not have been called Goswamis, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Supreme Lord himself, called them as Goswamis. And on what basis? Because of their pure devotion. So Prabhupada says that the title Goswami is the monopoly of the pure devotees. Actually, nobody else should have this title. But from a cultural, legal point of view, some people may have been born in a particular dynasty where the surname may be Goswami. But that itself doesn't make a person a Goswami. Goswami means one who has conquered the senses. And who has conquered the senses? Generally speaking, without the practicing bhakti, it is very difficult to conquer the senses. So one who has devoted oneself to Krishna will be actually a Goswami. And then Prabhupada gives two possibilities. One is that somebody is born in the devotee's family and has truly controlled the senses, and such a person is a Goswami. Other is somebody is not born in the devotee's family, somebody is not born in the Goswami family, is born in a Vaishya family also. But by practicing devotional service, one has become a Goswami. So the fact that even the Western disciples of Srila Prabhupada were following the four regulative principles indicates that they were advanced, that they were serious about the practice of devotional service, and they kept practicing for years and years and years together. So Prabhupada said, especially those who have taken sannyas, they are advanced. So they should not be seen with material vision and rejected because of some peripheral considerations. So na pashyet, one should not see like this. And then Prabhupada, after talking about this, he talks about the criticism that happened on himself. Actually speaking, we discussed this briefly yesterday. We have to understand the history of the Gaudiya Math to understand the context of the criticism. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur preached vigorously, and he opened 64 Gaudiya Maths in India and further three outside India. One was in Rangoon, one was in Montreal, one was in London. Actually, Montreal and London, they were not exactly temples, they were centers. There were no deities over there, the centers were there. But basically, he did enormous outreach. And through that outreach, he got so many people to take up Krishna consciousness. And how would he do this? It was through his disciples. You know, he was now their inspiration, he was their leader. But his disciples were also very dedicated. And they all came together under the guidance of the spiritual master, and they preach vigorously. Now, when Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur departed in 1937, so at that time, he told his disciples to form a united body, a governing body commission, and work unitedly. So somehow his disciples just couldn't digest the idea. Now, to say that they disobeyed their spiritual master is true, but it is also a oversimplification of a very complicated situation. See, the tradition was that generally every sampradaya, every matha, every organization would have its mathadipati, its sampradaya acharya. So who is like one presiding head, and that under the authority of that person everybody else would function. So such a person's word is taken as final, and that is the way to resolve all problems. But when they had the idea that, okay, we have to form a committee, how will the committee work? Sometimes they will have discussions, debates, and whose opinion will be final? If a devotee believes, okay, this person, my spiritual master, my spirit is a pure devotee, and then actually is in contact with Krishna, and then whatever is speaking is actually the will of Krishna, then for the disciple to follow it is very easy. Okay, this is Krishna's will coming through. But then, can the disciple have the similar faith if, you know, there are a body of 10 people, and before taking a decision, they discuss, and they debate, and they vote, and after that a decision comes out. So now, is that a result of a political process, or is the decision that has come out, is that a result of a devotional process? So is this a resolution that is passed by a body of people? Is this the will of God? And is that a binding instruction for me, the way the instruction of a pure devotee who is connected with Krishna will be? So actually, Krishna can manifest his will in any way. Krishna, if a pure devotee instructs, this is how you should work, then by working in that way, Krishna's will become manifested. So we can't pigeonhole the ways in which Krishna will manifest his will to certain stereotypes. Krishna can manifest his will in many ways. But the point is, this is a difficult concept to digest. We would like things to be simpler. Yes, I have one authority. The authority is a pure devotee. And in the connection with Krishna, whatever that pure devotee speaks, is Krishna speaking. And it would make things simple. But that was not the way Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur wanted devotees to work. So they tried having a committee for a few days, but he just felt, we'll not be able to function like this. That's why they made one of them as a successor, and when that person, his authority couldn't be accepted by others, and then there was some sort of split, and then that person had some problems in spiritual life which aggravated the split, and then there were two parties which were created, and then the parties fought in courts. And there are many sincere disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur who were very distressed by this fighting in the court. The fighting was who will have the control of the property of the Gaudiya Math, especially the Bagh Bazar Mandir, which is very opulent. And there are many sincere disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur who just distanced themselves from the conflict and made their own mathas and tried to preach according to their capacity. But the power that the united institute Gaudiya Math had was lost forever because of these internecine conflicts. And then the isolated individual efforts. Then when Srila Prabhupada was trying to practice share Krishna consciousness as per the instruction of Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, Prabhupada several times tried to work with his godbrothers. Sometimes he even stayed in his godbrother's ashram, editing their magazines and trying to share Krishna consciousness that way. But somehow their vision was too parochial. They did not want the magazine to expand. So Prabhupada felt choked inside that. Then Prabhupada tried to, at a Vyas Puja of his spiritual master, tried to inspire them all to become united and to preach unitedly. But they did not take him very seriously. They thought his words as eloquent poetry and nothing more. And then Prabhupada himself tried to preach, but he was not offered any assistance. And then finally, he himself went to America all alone without any assistance. And even when he wanted, even when he got a sponsor who was ready to offer donations so that Prabhupada could build a temple in America. Prabhupada Singhania, who said he will help. But then all that was needed was the Indian government had to get clearance. That Indian government had to give clearance, and somebody had to go to the Indian government, apply and tell that this money, please clear it from the foreign exchange. So one of Prabhupada's godbrothers was very close to the president of India also. and he could easily have got the permission, but he did not do that. And none of his godbrothers actually came to help him at that time. And Prabhupada had to single-handedly, there's a chapter in Lilamrita, crying alone in the wilderness. That's talking about Srila Prabhupada's preaching in India all alone, especially in Delhi. But there was some Prabhupada situation even in America, when crying alone in the wilderness, nobody to help you. And there's also a chapter that it will not be possible to assist you. Chapter that talks about how from all sides he got the response, no, we can't help you, we can't help you, we can't help you. But Prabhupada, despite all these discouragements, continued his solitary effort with determination. And then with overcoming almost impossible difficulties, he made people into devotees. And he inspired them to take to Krishna consciousness and brought them to India. And then he wanted to show them the culture that he had introduced them to. And so he brought them to Vrindavan, to Mayapur, to Puri. And he introduced them to his godbrothers. Now, because Prabhupada had gone to America and had become successful in American preaching, so that brought him a lot of fame. And for many of his godbrothers, the idea that a person who had just been a peripheral member when Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur was there, that person should now become a mainstream leader. Not just the mainstream leader, a mainstream leader, but the mainstream leader. The primary, most visible, most celebrated exponent of Gaudiya Vaishnavism during their times. And they themselves who had been leaders, sannyasis, and very powerful speakers and preachers, they themselves got sidelined. So they somehow found it difficult to digest. Now of course there are several of Prabhupada's godbrothers who publicly and lavishly appreciated his efforts and his success, even saying that he is the Senapati Bhakta Protector in Chaitanya Bhagavat. He is Shakti Avishavatar. He has fulfilled the mandate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He has fulfilled the desire of Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur. They appreciated him also. But often there were others whose appreciation was actually a concealed form of renunciation. For example, when Srila Prabhupada brought a bus full of Western devotees to Vrindavan, it created a sensation in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada had been living in Vrindavan before. So, and at that time Vrindavan was quite a small place. So Prabhupada was like a hometown boy, you know, who had become successful in a foreign country. Suppose there's a small village, and in that village there's some boy who somehow comes in the merit list and goes to a very famous college, and in that college goes and gets a degree, and then becomes very famous, becomes popular, and then comes back. Then that child, that boy is like the pride of the village, and everybody comes to see and fete him and congratulate him. So like that, the leaders, the political, cultural leaders of Maya, of Vrindavan, decided to organize a public festival to congratulate Srila Prabhupada, to felicitate him for spreading the glories of Raja all over the world and making people from all over the world Krishna devotees. So at this program, one of his godbrothers came and he said, what Bhaktivedanta Swami has done, it is extraordinary. But he said, you know, we have been sannyasis and we have been preaching to elite class of people. Bhaktivedanta Swami was a businessman, and he had material skills of organization because of his Vaishya profession. And you know, as a Vaishya, he had to deal with all kinds of people. That's why, because of his material skills and because of his experience in dealing with all kinds of people, when he went to the West, he was able to preach to low class people, and he made them into devotees also. So, but anyway, whatever he has done is good, and we appreciate that. So actually, is this the appreciation? Is this minimization? That means, you know, we are very advanced, and we preach to high class people. You people preach to low class people. Okay, you did something good. We appreciate it. But actually, what was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Patita Pavan. He is not Pavan Pavan. You know, Pavan Pavan means he is not a purifier of pure. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu doesn't say that one has to be living a pure lifestyle before one gets his mercy. In fact, Nityananda Prabhu, when he heard about the misdeeds of Jagai and Madai, his eyes became big in excitement. Because he thought that if these people can be delivered, then Just as the Puranas sing the glories of Lord Narayan for having delivered Ajamil, then in the future everybody will sing the glories of Gaura for having delivered Jagai and Madari. And he said, this is how I want to celebrate the glory of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Proclaim it to the whole world by making him do that which would be otherwise impossible. To elevate these Jagai and Madai and to purify them. So that is the adventurous spirit of a devotee. So Prabhupada did that. So to actually take those who are at a very low level of consciousness and to elevate them, that is a sign of extraordinary potency. And that ambition is indicative of a true heart of devotion. So Prabhupada had that ambition, which indicated he had an intensely devoted heart, a heart devoted to glorifying the Lord. And not only did he attempt to do it, he succeeded in doing it. So after Prabhupada did all this, for some of his godbrothers to minimize him, to criticize him, was very unfortunate. And Prabhupada himself was quite pained by this at times. Yeah. So here we'll see that they were jealous. Prabhupada says, you cannot take disciplinary action against a pure devotee. You cannot advise, you cannot correct. The effect of this will be that it will be obstructive and dangerous for one's spiritual advancement. And what we should focus on is that the pure devotee is serving the Lord. And what do such people think? That what is the origin of this exclusion? They think that Krishna consciousness is limited to a certain section of people, a certain section of devotees, and a certain tract of land. So certain section of people means? At a global level, they may think that only people in India can become devotees. Or they may think not a certain tract of land, but even a certain section of people. A certain section of devotees, only Goswamis can initiate. These are misconceptions that are actually against the spirit of bhakti. And we see that the spirit of bhakti has always been opposed by the entrenched interests. Entrenched interests means those who were in power. And they wanted to stay in power, and because of their desire to stay in power, they wanted to put aside anyone who did not have that power. So historically, especially in the medieval periods, when bhakti spread rapidly all across India because of many saints, so the saints were often from lower castes, and they were opposed very strongly they were persecuted often by the higher caste people. So those higher caste people couldn't see that these saints had devotion. They only saw, you are from lower caste. How can you teach dharma? What right do you have to worship the deity? What right do you have to do this, do that? So they basically condemned. So there are many stories about different devotees, how despite their condemnation of being low caste, they were protected by the Lord and they were elevated. So bhakti has actually been very inclusivist. That bhakti includes everyone in its fold. So we see Haridas Thakur. You know, the Nawab bet him, Nawab arranged to have him beaten, not just because he was a Muslim who was chanting the holy names of a Hindu god. That was the perception of Nawab. But actually there were so many Hindus at that time that the Nawab would not even have noticed Haridas Thakur. But it was the Hindus who went and complained to the Nawab. What did the Hindus say? They said, actually this person is spoiling, he's a low caste person. He was actually Muslim, now he has become a Hindu, and he is teaching Hindu dharma to Hindus. He is contaminating our religion. Check him. It was at that time that Nawab Hussain Shah took action, and he called Haridas Thakur, and Haridas Thakur gave up excellent ideal, excellent interfaith speech. He said that actually the Puran and the Quran both talk about the same God, only one God. And he said, if you think that I am punishment worthy, then, if a Hindu became a Muslim, whatever punishment you would give him, you should give that punishment to me. Because different people worship the Lord according to how he inspires them from the heart. So, Nawab was quite impressed by the speech of Haridas Thakur. I am describing it very briefly. But the point is, it was an elaborate speech. But then his assistants were there and they were hardline. They said, punish him, whip him to death. And then he was whipped and whipped and whipped and he did not die. And finally his whipper said, if you don't die, then we will have to die. Because the king will sentence us to death. Then Haridas Thakur said, please, there's no need for you to die for my sake. If you feel, if for your living I have to die, that will make you happy, then I'll die. Just see how I die. And he went to Samadhi. So people thought that he had died, and they threw him into the water, threw his body. The devotees got the body back, and they were planning to get the body back, but Haridas Thakur, actually, he stayed in Samadhi for some time, his body kept floating. When he came out of Samadhi, he just came out, and he again came back to the court of the Chand. And he said that, yes, here I am, he was chanting Hare Krishna. So the Muslim authorities, basically they realized, this person has miraculous powers, is a saint, because we made a mistake by punishing him. And then they forgave him, and they said that there should not be any persecution of Haridas Thakur anymore. So the point which I am making by all this is, seeing the internal vision, seeing the defective vision, seeing my material vision has affected all traditions. You know, even Jesus, when he was crucified, why was he crucified? The Romans, they did not want to interfere in the religious affair of the Jews. Jesus was born in a Jew family, but he was overthrowing the ritualism that had become the centerpiece of the Jewish religion at that time, of the religious culture at that time, and he was trying to bring some spiritual vibrancy and return to the essence. So at that time, when he was betrayed, what happened? It was Jews who opposed Jesus, and they complained to the Roman authorities. And then the Roman authorities decided to have him tried and in a mock trial, and they had him sentenced to death, and he was crucified. So the point is that those who have tried, taught the time-honored principles of devotion, they have faced persecution. So, as devotees, when Srila Prabhupada faced persecution, that is not unexpected, but what is unexpected is the source of that opposition. That is what distressed Prabhupada very much. If it had been the mainstream society criticizing, that would have been bad, but it was people who actually were fellow Vaishnavas like him, sometimes his own godbrothers, other Gaudiya Vaishnavas. They were acting in ways that was rebukable, and that was what distressed Srila Prabhupada very much. Of course, Srila Prabhupada was never discouraged. You see, he was distressed. You know, naturally, he saw his godbrothers as his equals. If you were all disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur. And Prabhupada, one comes and says that, you know, ultimately we are doing his work. If Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur sees it fit to work through me, then who am I to stop him? And not only who am I to stop him, I'm no one. But even if my godbrothers are truly devoted to Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, then they should be able to see Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur acting through me. Then they will make spiritual advancement. So, now Srila Prabhupada, he continued his sharing Krishna consciousness no matter what the difficulties he faced. And that's how he built a Krishna conscious movement. And not just Krishna conscious movement, he inspired many devotees to many things within the Krishna conscious movement. And by that he attracted many, many people to Krishna's feet. Now, if you look at a pure devotee, why should we not offend? Because we cannot be sure, because the defects are external material, because we are not here. Our goal is not to find our faults with others. Our goal is to serve Krishna and to return back to Krishna. To the extent, for the sake of that purpose, if we have charge of disciplining, regulating, overseeing the spiritual lives of certain people, then we can do the whatever is required to help them in whatever way is possible. But we can't make that as a license, a justification for all lack of affection in our relationships. So to advise, to correct a pure devotee, as some people try to do, they are all offensive and they should all be avoided at all times. And now we can see over here, this circle, why? What about Prabhupada disciples? Prabhupada did not appreciate the extraordinary activities of spreading Krishna consciousness worldwide. And if empowered persons don't preach, then who will? And Prabhupada quoted that Krishna Bhakti Nahitar Pravartan, Krishna Shakti Nahitar Pravartan. So without the energy of Krishna, without the empowerment of Krishna, one cannot bring about any change. The fact that Prabhupada was able to bring about change indicated that Krishna Shakti was there. And the fact that Krishna Shakti was there indicated that Radharani was there. So thank you very much. Shri Upadesha Amrit Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.